Welcome back to the program. Well, we talk about newspapers today as entities, as brands, as institutions that need to change to reflect new economic and technological realities. The fact is they are first and foremost homes and platforms for reporters and great reporting, and that has not changed. One of the institutions that has been such a platform has been the Washington Post. My guest this morning, journalist Dave Kindred, has been a journalist since he was 18 years old, and in his new book, Morning Miracle, he brings us up close and personal inside a 21st century newsroom as the newspaper industry struggles with fitting in to a new age. Dave Kindred has been a Washington correspondent, a sports columnist, a general interest columnist. He's the author of the previous book, Sound and Fury, the dual biography of Muhammad Ali and Howard Cosell. It is my pleasure to have Dave Kindred here today to talk about his newest work, Morning Miracle, Inside the Washington Post, a great newspaper, fights for its life. Dave, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Jeff. I appreciate it.
Great to have you here. When we talk about newspapers, should we do more? Should we spend more time talking about the distinction between the newspaper as an entity and, in fact, what it is that exists inside the paper, the reporters, the reporting, the gathering of news and information?
I think that's the essential question, Jeff. I first touched a newspaper probably when I was 10 years old. My grandmother in Lincoln, Illinois, sent me to the train station every Sunday morning to pick up the Chicago papers. Very few days have passed since then where I haven't held a newspaper. And as much as I liked that, and as much as it became a habit, and in fact more than a habit, you know, an essential part of my life, I don't much care about newsprint. Now, you know, people have told stories forever, you know, told stories on cave walls.
Right.
So I don't care how they tell me the story. You know, if you want to deliver it, you know, by, you know, electrons to my eyeballs, that's fine too. You know, the newspaper may no longer exist. I want the stories. I want great reporters doing investigative stories. I want reporters holding our government, our politicians accountable for what they do, holding all public institutions accountable. And I think that's what great newspapers, great news organizations have always done, and that is what's in peril here. You know, The title of the book is somewhat misleading. Mm-hmm. It says a great newspaper fights for its life. You know, the Post is fighting for its life as a news organization, as a news gathering organization. They don't care if it's in print or if it's online. In fact, most newspapers today would rather make their money online because it costs less. You don't have to buy newsprint. You don't have to buy ink. You know, but no one's figured out a way yet to make that kind of money, the kind of money necessary to support great reporting. No one's figured out how to make that money online yet.
But there seem to be two problems in this analysis. One is what you're talking about in terms of redefining and finding the economic model that will allow for this storytelling, that will allow for this kind of reporting that you speak of, within the context of this new online or digital model. But the other part of it is that we seem to be losing sight of what the real role of journalism is, this business of telling stories. And somehow that seems to get lost as we make this transition.
Well, it's a revolution. Transition is the proper word, and it's even more than that. It's happening so fast that it's a revolution. You know, where journalism is in a spin cycle. No one really knows where it's going, how it's going to get there, and what's in danger. And I think that's what you're suggesting there, Jeff, is that we lose sight of how to do the job. And part of that is the polarization of America in politics and news and everything else. You know, so many people today go to news sites or listen to radio, listen to TV, just to reaffirm in their own mind what they already believe. You know, and it's everyone's working from an agenda instead of working to just do straight reporting and tell me the story. Tell me the story straight. Give me the facts. Let me make up my own mind. And I think that's what's being lost in this revolution. I mean, there's so many, when everyone has a voice, and that's what the internet does, when everyone has a voice, you lose track of what voices to trust, what voices have credibility. And that's the great battle, I think, that the great news organizations, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, the Wall Street Journal, you know, those kind of organizations, that's the challenge that they face these days.
What is the mistake that reporters and that these organizations as institutions, do you believe, has? What mistakes have they made in not accepting some of the realities of the way news and information is transmitted today and taking an attitude that is still too much akin to the monopoly, essentially, that they had 20, 50, 100 years ago?
I think what happened was that they were all rich. You know, they were all rich. They were all fat and happy. You know, newspapers for 100 years had what you accurately described as a monopoly. They saw no enemies. And when this enemy, the Internet, appeared, they didn't quite know what to make of it. You know, not quite. I mean, they had no idea what to do with it. And it's taken them, well, it's been almost 20 years now, and newspapers still haven't mastered it. But their only, you know, their only balm in all of this is that the Internet hasn't learned how to make money either with news. You know, Amazon.com makes money. Google makes billions of money. The search engines make money. But no one selling news online has figured out a way to make money. And you can fault newspapers for not getting on board quickly. In fact, in my book, I tell a story about the Post. A managing editor in 1992 went to a convention, a conference of multimedia executives, the future of the media in Japan, and he came back, this is 1992, 18 years ago, saying that the Washington Post needed to get on board, they needed to create an online newspaper, they needed to do online classifieds, and they did some of that, but it took them 4 years to do even something. And one of the interesting things about that memo by Robert Kaiser was that he very accurately predicted Craigslist. He said that newspapers needed to do classified that was much more advanced, much more sophisticated, that used data they already had. His example was, if you were buying a used car for your college student, would you rather just look for used cars, or would you rather know for used cars under $6,000, under 50,000 miles? And that's what Craigslist does now. Of course, Craigslist does it for free.
Right.
And free is not a model that works for newspapers that have to have a, you know, newsroom staff of 500 people. So newspapers are very slow getting on, very slow figuring it out. And while some of the websites are very good now, New York Times website is good, the Washington Post website is usually, you know, one of the three or four most visited websites there is, they still don't make significant money. The Washington Post, if you can call it a failing newspaper, is it failing circulation, failing in revenue, as all major metropolitan newspapers are, it still makes 10 times more money than it makes online. And that's the model that no one has figured out. And I don't think anyone's even close to figuring it out. So, you know, the danger is that journalism will be diminished to a point where it no longer serves the purpose that, in fact, the founders of this country wanted it to serve.
There is a certain irony in that journalism itself, that the business of journalism, of gathering information, disseminating information, that this business has been so slow to catch on to what's going on.
Well, I think that's the knock against it. And I think, again, you know, it's not so much that it's a business, it's a monopoly. They saw no reason to change. They thought they had a business model that would work forever. So when it suddenly was broken, when suddenly the Internet came and offered news for free that people ran to, they had no way to counteract that. The consumers have been, you know, not reactionary. They react to events instead of foretelling events. It's not a, it has never been an industry that's famous for research and development. If it were, you know, in fact, the Post, and I couldn't find this out for sure, so I never wrote it, but at one time I was told that the Post was offered 10% at the time of Netscape, which became, you know, was a multi-billion dollar company for a while, but they declined there. You know, they had a deal, I think, with Facebook. They declined there. It didn't seem to be anything that they were familiar with, and newspapers forever have been very slow to change. And that's, you know, that makes the problem even worse now.
You spent a lot of time inside the newsroom at the Post. Talk a little bit about how all of what we have been talking about is impacting individuals, personalities, and the very business that the paper is in.
I think the primary thing that it's done in the last, let's say, 5 years. I started work on this book 4 years ago at a lunch with Lynn Downey, the executive editor of the Time, just asking him if I could have access to the newsroom. You know, he said, of course. Didn't say, of course. He said, great idea. He said, you know, we're not going to sponsor it, but you can, you know, people can talk to you if they want to talk to you. That was fine with me. But I think the primary thing I learned in the 4 years was that everyone's afraid. Everyone is anxious. You know, Gene Weingarten, the great humor columnist at the Post, said everyone's hiding under their desk because no one knows what's happening. When I started this project, the Post had maybe 750 people in its newsroom. Now, 4 years later, they may have 450. Been buyouts that have reduced staff. Some, you know, it's called a voluntary incentive retirement program. Several people have said to me there was nothing voluntary about it. You know, if you didn't take the buyout, you were threatened, basically, with jobs that would make you miserable enough that you would quit. So I think that, you know, morale was down. Morale in newsrooms is always bad, but this was the worst that I've seen. I wanted to do a book that was fun, but I didn't find much fun going on because most people were worried personally, then worried for the company because, you know, I started to say oddly enough, maybe it is oddly enough, but people at the Post love Don Graham, the owner, the chairman of the board. And so they felt badly for him, too, being in this fix, and felt badly for the business. They still did great work, still did good work, but it was always an anxious, nervous making time.
And yet if you go into journalism schools today and talk to young people, there is a kind of excitement, a kind of enthusiasm among those that want to pursue journalism and have a very different attitude than the kind of morale you're talking about that you see in newsrooms today.
Well, the people I'm talking about, of course, at the Washington Post are at the top of their game.
Uh-huh.
You know, these are people that have spent their lives getting to the Washington Post. Once they're there, then they're working at the highest levels of journalism. And they've been at it for 20, 30 years. You know, I've said often, I wish I was 25 years old. I'd be excited, too. I mean, I think that there are so many opportunities now, so many different ways to do the job that weren't available. When I was a kid, all I needed to do was learn how to type. You know, I was the only boy in typing class in high school. You know, today you need to know audio, you need to know video, podcasts, blogs. You know, there are you know, a dozen tools available that you must master that weren't available, and I didn't much care about them. You know, but it's a different time, and it's an adventure right now. It's an adventure into the unknown. One of the characters in my book is a young man named James Holman, went to Stanford, came to the Post as an intern, spent two summers as an intern, and you know, the question was, if you're 21 years old, you're bright, you're eager, you're ambitious, do you make journalism your career? Well, he decided he would because he just thought that the thrill of the hunt, the thrill of the adventure, going into the unknown. He said, I could be an academic, I could be a lawyer, but what fun is that? Mm. You know, he'd much rather pursue a story. And that's what he's doing. And those kind of young people, you know, are what we all used to be. And I think that's human nature. Those people still exist. They want to know what's happening. They want to know it before anybody else knows it. And they'll be there. And I think that, or at least I hope, that the pendulum swings back. I hope that in 10 years, 5 years, that readers, consumers will understand what they're missing, that the great reporting has been diminished, may not even be there. And then we'll start demanding it, and we'll be willing to pay for it. I think news has value, and right now people are giving it away. And I think that's been a mistake that has to be self-correcting in some way.
And, of course, you talk about this in the context of some of the great reporting that has been going on at the Washington Post, the coverage of Virginia Tech, people like Dana Priest and Anthony Shadid, that have been doing great work in spite of all of this.
Well, that was the book I wanted to write. When I started the book, Jeff, you know, when I started thinking about such a book was 15 years ago, probably. You know, and I wanted to do the romance. I wanted to do the derring do. I wanted to do the adventure. I wanted to do the fun of what reporting is, the fun of what writing is. Because to me, that's what newspapers are. That's what newspapers, that's what journalism has always been and always will be in some form, storytelling. So the heart of the book for me are those chapters in which I talk about the reporting of the Virginia Tech massacre, Anthony Shadid's kind of life story as a correspondent in the Middle East, the Dana Priest and Ann Hull investigation at Walter Reed that changed America, changed the way that we treat wounded veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. And I talked to those people at great length, you know, dozens of times. Gene Weingarten, as I said, the humor columnist, you know, probably the best long-form narrative writer in journalism today. I wanted to know how they did it. I wanted to know who they were, why they did it, and how they did these particular stories. And I got lucky in the sense that the year that I chose to be inside the newsroom was a year that this work, the Washington Post work, won 6 Pulitzer Prizes. It was unprecedented. New York Times won 7 in the year of 9/11, but they all were kind of variations of 9/11 coverage. The Post, in the year that I was there, won in commentary and features and public service and breaking news and criticism. You know, they won across the board. So it was a year of triumph for the Post and a year of nervousness also, because even when they were doing great stuff, they knew that the financial underpinnings were uncertain. So it was there was a great ambivalence there. But that's the book I wanted to do was that one. The heart of the book was the reporters doing the great hard work that they do.
And, of course, the other part of it, somebody you write about in the book, David Marinus, talks about the importance of being on the scene, of going there for reporters, and how that adds something to the narrative that you don't get in a lot of the stuff that's given away today.
Well, you don't get it in any of it. You know, and that's, Marinus, of course, was instrumental in the Virginia Tech coverage. I mean, and I dealt with David a lot on that. I mean, he put together, go back to 9/11. 9/11, David did a 5,000-word narrative that he produced in a week that told you the story as you would tell it to a friend. You know, so when the Virginia Tech thing happened, he was asked to do such a narrative again. He came into the office and he did 5,000 words in 3 days this time, because 5 days now seems like an eternity. 3 days even seems like an eternity. But until you have, you know, real reporters with the talent and skill and the ambition and the curiosity of real reporters out on the street talking to people, you know, feeling it, until you get that, you can't really understand a story. You know, and that's what great news organizations do, in the sense that they have the money, they have the time and the resources. The Post right now is running a series called Top Secret America. Dana Priest is instrumental in it. 2 years' work. You know, bloggers can't do that. Bloggers don't know how to begin to do that. The Huffington Post gets all this attention as an online source these days, and it's done by people working for free. For free. You know, they may have, 30 full-time people just putting the site together, but they have no real reporters. They use other people's stuff. And in the end, I believe people will recognize there's nothing there.
And most of it is simply aggregated from other sources.
It's a great curating source, yes. It's gathered from other places. And, you know, I don't quite understand the fascination with that kind of stuff. Yeah, it's all there, but give me the original stuff. Give me a news organization that is producing its own stuff at great cost with great ambition and great skill.
What attention is paid and what talk is there within the context of the newsroom to what readers want, to the fact that like it or not, and you and I may not like it, but there is a desire on the part of a large part of the public for more shorter material, pre-digested material, if you will. And it's very hard to counter that trend.
Well, it's probably impossible because that's, you know, everyone's life seems to be busier these days. You know, I imagine that Shakespeare probably had the same thing 500 years ago. Everybody's so busy these days. They don't have time to come watch a play. You know, so I don't know. You know, but certainly newspapers, news organizations are probably, I would hope, much more responsive to their customers these days than they ever were. You know, one sign of that, I think, is the great interactivity that the Internet proposes and makes happen. I don't like a lot of the comments that are attached at the end of stories, but I guess that's part of the price of interactivity. But there's much more transparency telling people how the process works, how we do it. I think maybe that's one of the reasons that the people at the Post were so cooperative with me, in the sense that they understood that it's a different world. They no longer can be separate from that world, you know, as if on high, you know, declaring to that world what it is. They now know that they have to be part of that world, and I think most newspaper people now understand how important that is.
Talking about some of the old-timers at the Post that you spend time talking about in Morning Miracle, and how they are reacting to all of this from a very different context.
Well, I guess Lynn Downey would be the primary target of that, in the sense that he had been there for 43 years. He'd been a reporter, he'd been an editor, became executive editor. You know, he was happy, he thought, with the idea of the Internet. He was happy with the idea of all the bells and whistles that online gave you. And yet, when it came time for Don Graham, the chairman of the board, to say, you know, we must be an online operation, and he changed publishers to his niece, Catherine Weymouth, you know, the signal then was that, you know, we have to combine these operations. We have to combine the news operation, both in print and online, under one editor, and that editor probably is not the man who's been there for 43 years, whose only interest, Lynn Downey's only and great interest, was the next morning's paper. So it was time to get more of a visionary, and I think that's what they believe they have in Marcus Brockley, brought him in from the Wall Street Journal. And Downey was honest enough afterwards to tell me for the book that he says, maybe if 5 years ago they had asked me to be the visionary, maybe I could have done that. Huh. No, actually, he said, I could have done that. And then he said, maybe I could have done that. You know, I think he knew that he was a print guy throughout. He welcomed the bells and whistles and talked the good game, but he didn't believe it or really understand it in the way that someone 20 years younger, 30 years younger, understands the web. And I don't know that Broccoli understands the web either, because at some point in time, the executive editor of the Washington Post media is going to be someone who has worked only on the web. That may be the next guy. But right now, there's still a print sensibility that overrides it. And until they completely webify, then it's going to be still the Washington Post, probably of Lynn Downey and Ben Bradley's imagination.
And yet, in the midst of all of this, there are still people like Marinus and Woodward who have success writing in even longer form and writing books.
It's, I don't quite understand it. You know, there's a difference in venue. I mean, those are both, Marinus is a great writer and reporter. Woodward, you probably go the other way, is a great reporter who can write, and they have had, they've built success, and a lot of that success comes from being associated with the Washington Post, and that will continue. Whether it continues in the newspaper, Woodward does hard news. Marinus is much more of a feature writer. There's room for both of them, certainly should be room for both of them in any newspaper. But it worries me that it's less and less all the time, that people do want it shorter, they want it digested, they don't want to spend time thinking about it. If they see a story that jumps to another page, they don't want to read it. That does worry me. As long as there are great people like Marinus, great people like Woodward, and there are the young ones. Woodward was a kid once. Woodward was a kid, in fact, when he did Watergate. Been there 6 months. I have great hope for the future.
Dave Kindred, the book is Morning Miracle, Inside the Washington Post. Dave, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Well, thank you for having me, Jeff. I really appreciate it.
We'll take a break. I'll be right back.